You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Carlos and Ali, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you, Marty.
This is, I'm happy to be speaking with you guys because it's a budding theme on this show. Very small theme, but a budding one. And one that excites me because I think it's a signal that Bitcoin is breaking out of the bubbles, the community bubbles that have existed in my 12 years following. It seems that what you guys are doing at Forager really validates Bitcoin being used as a tool by anybody, not just cypherpunks or people that care about sound money, but what you guys are doing at Forager in the world of entertainment. And Carlos, we were just talking before we hit record that you heard my discussion with Johnny Vance from Tuttle Twins in Angel Studio and reached out. And as I was also telling you, I have a friend, a very, very close friend, and we've been talking about this idea quite a bit, the intersection of Bitcoin and entertainment in an attempt to get better art into the world and let smaller artists, content creators, whatever you want to define them as, get their work into the world and actually give them a chance to compete with the mega studios of the world. So before we jump into the broader discussion of this intersection, why don't we start with a couple introductions, just how you guys got to where you are, what you're doing at Forager, and what got you to thinking about Bitcoin specifically.
Sure. Carlos, I can give my intro and I'll let you take it. So I went to film school. I majored in screenwriting, and then I found my way to New York. I landed in advertising. So it was not where I expected to be after film school. You know, right out of film school, I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to work for a studio. I'm going to be on set. I'm going to, you know, live the dream. And I found that being on set and everything that I had imagined about filmmaking, once I did get my feet wet into some live action production for commercials, was not super aligned with the way that I prefer to live my life and to structure my life. I'm very routine oriented. And I really enjoyed how the tech side of post-production was evolving and could make so many more things possible than, you know, just what is captured on set. Now, so much respect for what happens on set. I just was not of that same, you know, mindset and stamina to be working those kinds of hours. And so I found my way into the post-production side of advertising and worked as an EP at a couple of different post houses. And along the way, I met Carlos and we decided to start Forager together after working together for some time. And I was getting ready to move into the freelance world, which he had been occupying for his entire career up until that point before moving from New York to Portland. So that was what gave the idea to start Forager as a remote collective of post-production artists. We saw at the time that there was a real need to give a platform for individuals in the post space who were not represented by legacy post houses for any number of reasons. You know, they enjoyed being freelance. They liked the autonomy, having their own brand, and they just needed that production support, which I could bring to the team and which we've built alongside the producers at Forager along the way. And different tech was available to us at that time, at like Slack and Frame.io, that made it possible to collaborate in real time from anywhere. So we launched Forager with this unique perspective on bringing together the best talent, no matter where they were located. So we're pioneers in that sense because it was still different to say that we didn't have a brick and mortar place to go to for clients to go to supervise. And then that was January 2019. A year later, it became the norm during COVID for everyone to work remotely. So they're a little bit ahead of the game there. And we've taken everything we've learned from building this this network of great creative. And Carlos will give his intro on how we started building Bitcoin into the picture as well along the way.
Essentially, exactly what Ali said. I think Bitcoin surprisingly entered our radar very early on, almost by chance, because we started the company in 2019, the pandemic hit 2020, and we were down, of course, as everyone else for a little bit. And at that moment, I was starting to just research, what stocks to buy, like every person back then. And I stumbled upon Bitcoin at the moment, just from an interview that I saw on YouTube. And I bought it personally, not knowing much, just kind of bought it personally as an opportunity. Ali and I are good friends, so I talked Ali into buying some personally as well. And we were so small and informal. We were why not buy it and put it on Forager's balance sheet? And this was before Sailor had appeared on X. It was June 2020 when we first bought. And we were small. We just bought, one to begin with. We saw the whole strategy thing happening. We were like, oh, this is going to be a thing. So we started buying more. Still a humble treasury, of course we rode the whole thing up to the 60K. Then we felt a little silly when, it went all the way down in the bear market. But that was kind of our introduction to Bitcoin. We buy buying it almost naively at first, not knowing much, but then you see this thing going up. We learned what it was. We got orange pilled in the process. And we thankfully held it for this whole time. And it was only in earlier this year where we were dealing with some liquidity crunches that we were we have built this treasury. We want to maintain it. And we thought, what if we were to leverage that treasury in order to raise some funds so we can survive and get through this rocky period? And so we did that, but we also announced to the world, we are proud Bitcoin holders, and we have a mandate now of holding this Bitcoin treasury and growing it. And that's on the Forager side, and eventually comes the film studio part, which is our next chapter.
Yeah, it's funny. This is a bit of worlds colliding for me, because my wife, she did post-production for McCann Erickson for, 12 years. And she was on the Microsoft account. And Ali, as you're describing those long nights in post-prod, there was weekends where she'd be working till 2 a.m. every night. And I think her team specifically did localization for global campaigns.
Yes.
And yeah. So the her coming home after those long nights, just describing, I was like, what do you guys do? It's like, we just sit in a room and rewatch the commercial about 1,000 times and try to nitpick and make sure everything's compliant.
I learned a lot about post-production basically from doing localization initially, because you have to really understand all the files that you need to update the graphics, the voiceover. I had some really late calls, trying to get voiceover from the team in China, those sorts of things. It's very technical. You do watch the same thing over and over again, but you get the detail-oriented part of it and why it's so important.
And there's funny intricacies, France or South Korea, I forget, you can't have electronics in the same still as water or something like that.
You do learn a little bit about what plays in different markets, what is and isn't allowed. So not to say that post-production doesn't have late nights, it certainly does, but it can be a little different still in how much you can control the different factors, I feel like.
Yeah. But tying this into what your initiative is now, she was on the Microsoft account for 5 or 6 years. And I got an arm's length perspective of just the world of like big corporate sort of ad spend and like how much money they were putting into it and what was actually being produced, and they put together great commercials. But it was always insane to me, like how much they were spending on all of this. And when you think of trying to compete with that, like it becomes hard. And in this post-COVID world that you guys described, it seems like it's becoming easier, but you just need to combine a bunch of tools and creative thinkers to really be the upstart competitor with these behemoths, whether it's in the corporate world doing advertisements or in the film world with the major studios. And so I think that's a good jumping off point for the white paper, the studio, and how you guys are thinking of basically arming indie creators with the financial tools to make sure that they can get their art out into the world.
Yeah. So like you said, from all that we've learned competing with these big companies and holding our own, because we could see that we needed to be nimble, and that really is the name of the game, especially with how quickly things like AI are moving. Every week, it seems like there's a new development and something that is making the expectation that you should be moving faster and doing things cheaper. That is affecting every part of filmmaking. And as we've seen through putting Bitcoin on our balance sheet at Forager, it is the one thing that's actually preserving our hard work in the long run. And when we realized we could have a model to help filmmakers with this, because we still need great films that are telling human stories that are made by people with people and not just leaning into AI to make things faster and cheaper, because there just isn't the same amount of funding available anymore. Let's incorporate the tech and the tool that is Bitcoin to preserve those efforts. And like Carlos said, and you know, we can talk about more, separating the investment from the art to a degree, you know, bringing in a whole nother set of investors who are interested in the returns that can be offered from our model, and not just waiting for a film to make money. Of course, the hope for everyone is that the film will sell and be seen and generate returns. But you know, let's lean into the Bitcoin backing to bring in more money, and then we can use the returns from a sale of a film to reinvest in the company and back more films and continue this cycle. You know, continue to invest in our stories and our people, and not just participate in a race to the bottom, which is what we were feeling we were becoming a part of.
Yeah. So I do want to touch on the AI stuff. We can do that later, but I think just digging into the problem that indie filmmakers have right now, let's sort of paint that landscape for the audience. What are the biggest pain points that indie filmmakers run into? I imagine capital is one of them, but how hard is it for them to compete, I guess, is the question.
I mean, I guess as a first step for context, I think film is perhaps one of the riskiest business you can get into as an investor, in the sense that you can have a great recipe for success with like a great script and great talent and a great director, and the movie can still flop. Like, it can still get no traction. So of course there's a lot of pressure on the investing side. And I think you touched upon a little bit on the episode with Johnny, but yes, like, especially in slower times, I think Hollywood and even the streaming networks, they're betting on safer projects. There's a lot more bet on sequels and spin-offs, and any project that will guarantee some sort of success or return for the investor. So, of course, that leaves artists with original ideas and riskier projects that have no track record of financial success at the bottom, you know, of the up of the list. We We think that betting on great talent and original ideas is a winning formula, but you have to give it time and you have to like experiment and try. And I think there are not many companies betting on that kind of raw story or film at the moment. We really like, for example, A24, what they did, especially in the early days. Like they were thinking very long-term, betting small amounts of money, but on like really risky projects, just trying to build the IP for the future. And I think they were very successful at it, and they built a brand around it and even a cult following. But of course, as you grow and you become more established, that kind of risk taking can only last for so long. And of course, they had to take investor money in the last, I forget when it was that they took like a big round of a private investment. And of course that changes the recipe, right? Like they, now you have people depending on you to make your numbers, and that affects ultimately the artist, right? Like there's less funds going around for new risky original IP. So that's kind of like the biggest problem that we set out to solve with this. Ali, I don't know if I missed something.
No, I mean, bottom line, I do think the biggest issue is access to capital. And the reason why is, you know, multifaceted. But if you're talking smaller than A24, it's finding those investors. And I know that a lot of our independent artists are relying on angel investors, friends, family, Kickstarter. You know, it takes a lot to bring together a production, and there's often no guarantee that the investors are going to make their money back. And this is how people have to start. You know, you got to start somewhere. I think very few get into the industry right away with name recognition and a lot of backing and investors who know for sure they're making their money back. So along with the other challenges in this industry, I see this contributing to a diminishing amount of available funding for original ideas. Like I said, it does feel like a race to the bottom. And we've only seen Bitcoin preserve the value that we brought to our clients and our companies. So let's bring that, you know, make it available to independent artists. But also it's not just about, convincing people to invest in Bitcoin, because most people still obviously do not feel comfortable. And so let's make this appear as accessible as possible for investors, so they can look at it as an alternative to their stocks or, you know, the 401k or whatever might be giving them between 5% and 10%, you know, and they can also contribute to the arts. Because I do think that there is a large selling point from the conversations I've had of saying, hey, we can preserve original storytelling and, potentially beat the hurdle of AI that is coming for all of the films and the content that we're consuming. And they want to be a part of that. And it's great that then they can make some, you know, money and potentially beat inflation along the way.
Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. They make the Cold Card Q, my favorite hardware wallet, the most secure hardware wallet on the market. As you can see, it's got the BlackBerry form factor, full keyboard. It's got two secure enclaves. You create your private public keys offline. The device never has to go online, never does go online. So you keep your Bitcoin secure. If you have your Bitcoin on exchanges and you're looking to get it off, secure it in the best way possible. Pick up a Cold Card Q. Go to coinkite.com, find the Cold Card Q, use the code TFTC for 5% off. If you're a power user of Bitcoin, like I am, if you're running a business on a Bitcoin standard, if you're just a Bitcoiner who wants to secure your Bitcoin, get the most secure hardware wallet on the market, go get the Cold Card Q. It's a beautiful thing.
Sup, freaks. Guess what? We launched a browser extension. It's called Opportunity Cost, and it helps you see the true cost of everything in Bitcoin. convert prices to Bitcoin as you browse the web. Opportunity cost automatically displays fiat prices in Bitcoin or sats, helping you think in a Bitcoin standard. It works on Amazon, Zillow, X, your bank account, QuickBooks. You can convert everything to Bitcoin. It's really cool. It's also 100% open source, MIT license. We don't collect any data. All of the conversions happen in your browser on your local device. It's a great way to recalibrate your life and begin thinking in sats. Go check it out at opportunitycost.app. That's opportunitycost.app.
Let's dive into the mechanics of how you guys are envisioning Bitcoin as a funding mechanism actually work. So is white paper just building a big treasury and using that to fund films, or is there intent? Like, because when you guys DM me and you sort of explain the top level of the idea in text, I couldn't help but think of a company that we've partnered with, a 1031 Battery Finance, but they're focused on the commercial real estate market, and they're a credit fund. So they raise dollars into a credit fund, underwrite projects, lend them dollars with a portion of those dollars, 10 to 20% being put in Bitcoin, held within the loan structure throughout the duration of the loan, typically 8, 10, 15 years, whatever it may be. Is your model similar in that sense, where it's a combination of dollars and Bitcoin, and you're sort of underwriting individual products and making sure that they're bolstered with a mini Bitcoin treasury?
Essentially, we took a lot of inspiration from Sailor, and also the original bond that we created ourselves for Forager. But basically, a film needs $50,000 for production, like a short film. We raise a bigger amount than that, and a portion of that amount raised goes directly into Bitcoin, which we use to repay the investor, and the rest goes directly into production. But by doing that Bitcoin split investment, we are able to repay the original loan plus the interest, which is 5 to 10%. So essentially, yes, we are growing a treasury that allows us to grow more and more. But then every film financed has a Bitcoin portion attached to it, and it's running in the back, and its function is to repay the original investor. And we're not paying the investor in Bitcoin. We're just paying them in dollars. And we have a few variations, but it's between 5 and 10%. Now, this is not something to make someone rich, you know, from these bonds, but it is essentially comparable to like high yield savings or like a treasury bond. But on the end of it, you not only get your 5 to 10% annualized return, you also get to finance a film. And on the artist side, we are able to tell them, you know, we are in charge of repaying the investor with our Bitcoin strategy, and you guys can just focus on the art, and you will not hear any notes from the investors. They have no say over the creative. So we like that separation, because we think that's how great films, you know, can be made.
That's a very important separation, right? So you guys are sort of acting as the how would I describe this? The wall of safety between the artist and the capital, and handling that. And it makes sense. So like, I guess from the investor's perspective, it's like, all right, I'm comfortable doing this because I have this, funnily enough, counterintuitive to most people, but it has proven to be true historically, de-risking by putting a portion of my principal in the Bitcoin that will at least preserve its purchasing power, if not potentially increase. And then they've got a call option on the movie being a massive success, I imagine, in getting royalties, because I imagine they get equity in the films themselves as well.
So it's funny. Right now, we have three variations of the product, and it's kind of like different for different risk appetites. The 5% yield one has Bitcoin securing the loan, not the full obligation, but the capital. And you get your 5%, you know, return. But if something were to happen into the company or anything, you know, that Bitcoin is pledged to you, and that Bitcoin is from our treasury. We have on the higher risk side, we have the 10% annualized, and that one has no early redemption. All these are set to 5-year loans so that, you know, we can let Bitcoin appreciate and we're not liable for all the fluctuations. So we have those products right now. And so far, nobody has asked us about equity in the film, surprisingly. And I think it's also because of our early investors. They didn't even care so much about the films. They were just kind of like, oh, I have mutual funds giving me this. I could just park it here and I get a better yield.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So it is kind of opening doors to capital that would never touch films. But of course, I think we have a whole gamma of potential people that could, you know, like that may also want some yield, as you're saying, like some kicker from the film.
Yeah. Is this model catching on? Is anybody in the film industry or just creative industry in general seeing what you guys are doing and being like, oh, this is interesting? Are they deriding you? Or are they cheering you on?
I would say that the response has been really positive. No one has come for us and said what you're doing is crazy and you should stop doing this. Maybe they think it. I wouldn't be surprised. But it's been very positive. It might be catching on. We don't know. But like you said earlier, we're really only aware of Angel Studios incorporating Bitcoin on the balance sheet in an, you know, entertainment company. We aren't aware of anyone else doing something similar. I think that it will eventually become part of the strategy for most companies. And you know, that's a broader conversation, I suppose, on Bitcoin treasury companies. But as far as we know, we're one of the earlier movers, and maybe people are waiting to see how it, you know, what kind of results we get from this.
And that's a good question, because when it comes to like Saylor and his strategy, and just Bitcoiners who've gotten to Bitcoin early, generally, it typically takes a bit of time for their conviction to be validated. And so, like, at what level would you consider the strategy a success for you guys?
Well, I think once we have repaid our first loan, like we're very new, we just launched the white paper anyhow. What, you know, Forager's been around for 6 years, but white paper we just launched a couple months ago, and maybe less than that actually. So our first two short films just filmed this last weekend. So we're going to head into post-production. We'll have something to share hopefully by the end of the year. We'll start submitting to festivals. I think in the next year, we'll really start to see how things are received, how the Bitcoin element is, you know, is part of the marketing or not part of the marketing. We're also not pushing that. I'm not trying to say, you know, everyone has to be talking about how it's backed by Bitcoin. I think it's an interesting talking point personally, you know, obviously, but our artists aren't, you know, we're not asking them to go out and spread the word about the Bitcoin backing unless they, you know, want to talk about how it's made it possible to fund their film. So I think in the next year or two, we'll start to see how, you know, it's changing the way that the industry is funding films. And for us, it'll be a first test of the model.
Yeah. And I also, I think we, right now we're dealing with shorter form projects, but I think the goal is to get features soon. And we think that in theory, as Bitcoin grows exponentially, so will our treasury, and we will have even more funds to play with then. And I think another portion of it is that we do want to make everything public and put kind of like the treasury live, but also how every film is attached to a Bitcoin-backed bond, online, and we want to show also the performance of each bond so people can see, oh, this film is being repaid live, you know, like with Bitcoin in the bag. So it's not just, I think it's a new way to measure a film's success. It's not just box office. It's not just, fees. It's art can be, funded with Bitcoin's performance.
Yeah, building in the open. That's massive.
Over 10,000 investors downloaded the original How to Position for the Bitcoin Boom when Bitcoin was just 27K, and it called for 120K plus. That target's now hit. So what's next? Tour de Meester is back with the 2025 edition, refreshed for the mid-cycle moment, packed with new data, new insights, and Tour's latest price outlook. Plus, you'll get exclusive access to Charting Our Way Through Chaos, Tour's new 30-minute Q3 2025 presentation explaining why this bull run might be only just beginning and what forces could push it to the next level. Read the first ever mid-cycle report from Adamant Research at unchained.com/TFTC. That's unchained.com/TFTC. And also, if you're using Unchained, you can use the code TFTC for $50 off any of their services. Go check it out.
On to the very interesting stuff. Like, what do you think the film industry is lacking right now in terms of types of movies that are being made, themes that are avoided, stories that aren't being told that you guys are excited to back?
That's a really good question.
Now, I'll add this just for some context, because my wife and I and our brother and sister-in-law, we were having a conversation a couple of weeks ago over dinner, how we all four of us have young children. We have between us four, soon to be five, under the age of 10. And we were sort of complaining to each other that there's no children's movies these days that actually have like real people. It's all like animated stuff. And we were reminiscing about the 90s movies that we loved, like Dennis the Menace, Home Alone, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, you name like a bunch of really good children's movies. What was the Stephen King movie about the boys? Can't believe that's escaping my name, my mind. But regardless, it seems like we have nonchalantly notice the sort of fiatification of kids movies, where it's like all these animated movies, which some of them are really good, but you're like, God, I wish the kids had like live action films like we did growing up that they just seem to be missing out on. And that's something that we were just a couple weeks ago saying, I wish somebody would fund movies like that.
Yeah. I mean, that is a great point. I also have a couple younger kids, and I love animated films. I was originally drawn to filmmaking because I loved the look of stop motion films, and then also realized I could never be a stop motion animator. Also a very hard thing to do all day long. So I love animation. I love what you can do there. But you're right, having live action and just seeing other real kids on screen. I know we're supposed to limit their screen time. I agree with that. But sometimes it's necessary. And like my one-year-old daughter loves to hold pictures of her family. And I think just seeing the real people in a photo is like still kind of novel, especially with the screens and, you know, all that they have access to these days.
Yeah, we had a Friday night movie night the other week, and the kids watched Meet the Parents, and it was just funny watching them react to it. They got emotional in some of the parts, and it's like, gosh, it feels, and that came out, I think, in like 2000 or 2001, and it's like, you don't have any great movies like that anymore. And then, Carlos, you mentioned it. We talked about it with Johnny. It just seems like Hollywood these days is just stuck in this sort of superhero universe sequel machine. It's like, okay, I don't need another Marvel movie. Let's get something interesting here.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna mention I got into filmmaking because of all the auteurs in the 90s, like Paul Thomas Anderson, Tarantino, even Sofia Coppola, and I feel like there was a cool trend back then of betting on artists with great vision, and you just bet a lot of money on them, and hopefully one of them will be a great film. I feel like that was a risk-taking form that doesn't exist as much anymore. Of course, there's still the big festival circuit and all that, but not a lot of studios betting on auteurs and trusting, you know, the artist's vision in that way. And I think it's, I'll get to what we're talking about, yes, like less risk-taking overall.
Yeah. Like, there's no modern day mall rats or Airheads.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's Dogma. Like, those are, I love those movies growing up. And it's just, and it seems like the deprecation of that risk taking happened pretty quickly within the last 15, 20 years, which may seem like a long time to some people, but really isn't that long a period of time.
No. And on a similar note, because I think what's kind of underpinning, you know, your examples and is comedy, and you know, with the cancellation late night with Stephen Colbert, and I was listening to a podcast about how comedy, like adult comedy films, also has seen, I don't know, it has not been something that studios have been investing in for a long time. We used to have, I don't know, like Anchorman and those sorts of movies that have just become classics, and they're so good, but they don't invest in comedy the way that they used to. And it also seems to be tracking this trend of comedians having their individual platforms on social media.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. Like, how much of the landscape has shifted because of the emergence of social media and these different mediums, because everything's gone to like 1-2 minute clips. And you see it like on, not that I'm on TikTok, but people share them on Twitter, and you see it on Instagram, like these individual creator accounts that have like a certain shtick and they make like a minute video. It's not incredible production, but it's enough to grab your attention, and a lot of the eyeballs are going there. And I think that's another sort of theme that's been discussed between my wife and our brother and sister-in-law, is like the attention span, like bringing back like longer form content and like putting your phone down and actually engaging in a piece of art for longer than 120 seconds and extending that to 120 minutes is something that I'd like to return to. And we went and saw the F1 movie a couple of weeks ago, and it was actually fun. It was a fun movie. I really liked it, and it felt good to be in it was the first time I was in the theater, I think, since COVID. Or actually, no, last summer we took the kids to see a movie, but I've only, since COVID, I think I've been to the theater like 3 or 4 times, maybe. And going to see movies in the theater is something that I think is becoming a lost sort of practice in society, and that's very sad because it is a fun experience.
Yeah, I saw this fascinating interview with Nikki Glaser, the comedian, and she was basically saying that she lives for the YouTube clips or the TikTok clips, and that's how people really consume your media, and that's how also they assess if you're successful at something, like if you are walking red carpets or if you have clips here and there. But when it comes to the numbers, nobody, even though all these comedians have these HBO specials, very few people actually watch all that. Like, the media really lives in all the clips and all the secondary content that people extract from all those specials, which is a little sad because we of course want to make long films and proper features. But yeah, then you're competing with the attention span of the new generation.
Yeah. And I mean, this ties back to Bitcoin too, because it's really incentive driven. All those platforms are trying to sell ads, and they just need volume of 1-2 minute clips getting millions of views to sell ads into, in the monetary sort of incentive disruption. That's how it manifests.
Exactly. Yep.
I do think when we skim over TV a little bit, because we're marrying this, you know, the short commercial side of things, which is like what Forager has done. And now with White Paper, we want to see a reemergence of original ideas and film. I actually consume like more TV than film. And there is still a lot of great content in TV and watching some really funny shows as well. So I feel like maybe that's where Hollywood's been hedging its bets a little bit in the streaming and the TV, because it does still, I guess, apply to our shorter attention spans. You know, we don't have to go to the theater and make a whole outing out of it and, you know, spend 2.5-3 hours. I think it's also been an interesting thing is that the movies have gotten so long. It's like to get you to commit to going to a theater and then spending 4+ hours. It's like it's kind of completely in the other direction. And I don't know if that was intentional, but it definitely keeps me from going to the theater. Not that I would be able to as much anyways, like you were saying too, it's pretty hard when you have young kids to find the time to go and make those arrangements. But then thinking, okay, if we're going to go, it's going to be a 3+ hour commitment. It's a lot because everyone's pretty busy.
Yeah. Like a 90-minute movie is perfect.
And yes.
I'm just a research Carlos, you were mentioning Tarantino. I think one of my favorite films of all time is Reservoir Dogs. And
okay,
just looked it up. 1 hour and 40 minutes. Probably longer back then. But yeah, if you can get like a 90-minute quick hit. And that's like, that's where the artistry really comes in, is the people that have the ability to like tell the story in a 90-minute span and really get you emotional and have you thinking after.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll watch something like Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon. Like, wait, I basically did watch a movie. So I'm telling myself I can't go make time for a movie. I mean, it's definitely easier to sit in front of my TV and stream something than going to the theater. But some of these shows are really long and they captivate you. And you go, oh my gosh, I can't believe I've been sitting here for, you know, over an hour. And I think there's a balance to be struck too there. And, you know, finding that, like you said, consolidation of a story into 90 minutes, which is what, when I was growing up, that was a full film for me too.
Yeah. I'm curious with the short films that you guys are funding now via White Paper, what type of themes and stories are they leaning into? If you're free to disclose.
Yeah. So what we're looking at right now, we do have, some comedy. So it seems to be, again, underpinning the discussion. And I think we're all looking for a bit of escape from the day to day. And that's what comedy can provide. So we have 2 short films that are comedic in nature. One's a satire as well on the fashion industry. And so I'm really excited to see that one come to life. And then we've got more of a coming of age story that will be in development next year. Also, more like deeply rooted in like the political polarization of our country. So that's interesting because I do think those themes are avoided, for I'm sure obvious reasons in Hollywood this time. And then another project that will be finished up early next year then is more like a documentary series, and there's a couple episodes for proof of concept there. So it runs the gamut, really trying to find a balance in our slate or our portfolio.
Yeah, and especially I feel like we're always trying to look for projects that don't seem like that are as commercially viable or that wouldn't seem as attractive to a traditional like film investor. And like one of the projects that we just shot this weekend is that it's basically just physical comedy, and it's 2 people physically fighting over a piece of lint that they found that fell on someone's shoulder. So it's no dialogue, pure fighting. And it's just, in my opinion, it's just original. Like a it doesn't have to fit a specific genre. So yeah, we're kind of playing with the whole gamma of like content.
Oh yeah. And I think it would be remiss of me not to bring it up because we mentioned it earlier, but what are your thoughts on this explosion of AI generated content, and how do you view it as people working in the industry? Is it a tool that you see yourself leveraging, or do you think there's going to be a market for, like, bolts to nuts, beginning to end, produced, shot, acted, produced by humans that people will want to consume instead of the AI? Because hand up, we've been experimenting with the AI generated content just to tell stories that we don't think are being told in little 2 minute clips, in an attempt to draw attention to a web browser extension that we launched. And it's been fun experimenting with that. But there is, like, a part of me, it's like, this is cheap, relatively easy. It's getting us good exposure, but there is the romantic in me that thinks that we need to preserve, like, actual human filmmaking, acting, and storytelling.
For sure. Yeah.
You have thoughts. No, I think it's a very sensitive subject, of course, in our field, because as much opportunity as there is, of course, a lot of people on the artistry side also feel the threat, because these programs are getting better and better every day. And I personally think that you still need a good amount of taste if you're going to be creating these creative videos or images, just because there's still a lot of AI that looks a little bit plasticky, a little bit, if you don't know how to prompt it, but also if you don't give it good references, it ends up looking still artificial, although that's changing. And it's still, I think a lot of people are treating it as more individual frames or individual clips, not so much like storytelling. Like, I've seen very few actual sequences that tell a story that moves you or have a beginning and end. So that's still, I think, in the starting phase. But I see a lot of opportunity, especially because we have this artist that we collaborate with a lot, and he's very much into AI. And he only sees opportunity. He's very tech savvy as well. And he was like, you know, in the past, if I had this idea of, like, spiders, robot spiders coming down from the ceiling, and I wanted to propose that to a client or to, like, another creative, it would be a whole discussion, right? Like, you would pitch it, and they would be like, okay, do we need a whole VFX team in India? So we can outsource it, because it's a lot of, like, work, a lot of man hours, and it's discussions with the VFX company. So it's a huge, long process just to come up with spiders coming from the ceiling. And he's like, with AI, I can do it overnight. I can just work on my prompts. I can be in the zone creatively, and I can accomplish my vision just myself with a computer. So in a way, that's really empowering, I think, for a creative as well. The question is, does the AI overtake that everyone, like even the person creating, making those decisions? I think that's the debate.
I do.
Sorry, Ali.
Done.
I was going to say it's been fun experimenting it with, like, but even what we've produced, like, it's obviously AI. We haven't crossed the uncanny valley either. And I'm under the belief that, like, all the AGI, ASI talk coming out of Silicon Valley from, like, the Sam Altmans of the world is more hype than actual oomph. Like, I don't think AI is going to be able to replace human creativity. So, like, the idea that you're just going to launch these models and they're going to come up with these unique stories that humans actually connect with, I'm a bit skeptical of, even with the crazy advancements that we've seen over the last few years. Could be wrong, but I don't know, I just have a hunch that you can't create consciousness in the digital world, in the machine world, if you will, no matter how vehemently Sam Altman and others are telling you that they're doing just that.
Yeah, and you're right. It is not a replacement for humans' ideas and good creative. It can augment it. It can be a great springboard. We've used it to concept things, you know, before they need to be sent to someone to really bring that vision to life, because it requires so many different tools. Even generating images, like Carlos has done for certain projects, just again, like, template, see what we could do. Someone wants this thing in, you know, in the shot to move faster or to behave differently. You know, what would it take? What could it look like? It's great for a kind of experimentation and stress testing, but it's not a magic bullet. And, you know, we were pitching on a job last week that has a really tight turnaround and needs a lot of VFX help. And the thinking is that, oh, because it's such a tight turnaround, like, let's just plug it into AI and make it happen, right? It's not like that. You know, you have to take into consideration continuity. And Carlos had brought up at that point during the pitch, you know, every time you generate the image again, something's going to be a little off. And you can get really good at prompting. You can only take it so far before someone else has to come in, another VFX artist, to, you know, make everything perfect and consistent, take certain things out and add others in so that you're not ending up with a new set of variables every time. So it's a great tool. It has definitely sped up some concepting for us and for clients. I know that they are leaning into it in advertising, you know, just to generate customer research and stress test whether a certain demographic will respond in a certain way to their idea. They can collate all of that research to, you know, ask the AI if it's going to work or not. I don't know how well that's going to serve them in the long run, but it's interesting because, like you said, building consciousness, that seems like too tall of a task. I think they're trying. I think they might get pretty close. But overall, it is not going to completely replace what we're doing. And we love novel things. And computers have to be trained on something and then know what to deliver consistently. And so I don't think anyone's going to react to AI content in the long run, like and engage in it the same way if we didn't have anyone coming up with the ideas that would make the content different or more, you know, more relatable for certain situations or what's going on, you know, in society. So there's always going to be a human driver, but it is causing the industry to contract because, like Carl said, things can happen faster. They can happen with fewer people. And so the entire industry, and by industry, I mean, you know, mostly speaking from, you know, post-production in the advertising space, but then, you know, further into narrative as well, we need to reorganize ourselves and understand that it's going to require even more nimbleness and more modular with our relationships and our vendors than even before. And that's been Forager's entire, you know, foundation, was being nimble. And we still find ourselves going, okay, let's keep up with this new tech. And what does this mean? What do we really need to invest in now?
Yeah. I feel like you guys are ahead of the curve just in the business model, being nimble, small, boutique. Maybe that might be the right word or the wrong word, but it's the word that comes to my mind. And hopefully, what I would imagine is there's definitely disruption going on, people worried, but hopefully that wall of worry turns into people recognizing, like, oh, there's a lot of opportunity here. And you see, like, the world of 1,000 flowers bloom, where instead of having the major studios dominate everything, people recognize that the cost have been cut and they can compete, and a world of 10,000 foragers emerges, and you have this sort of competition for storytelling, maybe a combination of human AI production. Maybe there'll be some that are just like AI only, others that are human only. And it could create like a really cool competitive environment that ultimately should lead to more creativity and better better film out there.
Yeah, definitely. And I was having a conversation with another person in our field a few months ago, and he equated an entirely human production in the future being like shooting on film now. Like, I really want to shoot on film. It's going to look so authentic, instead of, you know, just using a digital camera. And then it's like, oh, okay, well, let's think about that. We have to, you know, this is how you have to treat film and process it. And this is the lead time it takes. And if we just, you know, if we're short on time and money, we'll just use the digital camera. And I think that it is a very good analogy to use for, you know, as we move forward with AI, and it gets better and better. It's like, okay, what is it? You have time and money and you want to make something that's entirely human, no AI, et cetera. Great. But do we, you know, need to make some sacrifices or, you know, cut a few corners and bring in the AI? And that's just something that's going to be part of everyone's thinking when they're doing their concepting and strategy.
Yeah, and as you guys are proving a white paper, like, Bitcoin can be the tool to enable that those teams that want to, like, be the film of the next era, recording on film of the next era, which is doing everything with humans only. Like, that's enabled with smarter and smarter capital or funding for these films.
Yeah. Yeah, like we said in the beginning, it preserves the effort that we're putting in today. And, you know, our industry has seen a bit of a race to the bottom because your money doesn't go as far. And everyone's companies, you know, operations have been contracting for a number of reasons. So your nest egg for making that film might only get you half a film by the time you get around to making it. So that's the other thing, is it takes a long time to raise capital and set up a production. And you know, you just can't keep up. You can't really keep up. And so you've got to find ways to do it cheaper and faster. And unfortunately, that doesn't support, like, original, good, creative filmmaking in the long run.
Yeah. This is exciting. Like I said in the beginning, I love having you two on because I think it's a validation that Bitcoin is breaking out of the relatively small bubble it's existed in its first 16 years since the protocol launched. And I'm a true believer in sort of people seeing a company like Forager and White Paper doing what you guys are doing, getting inspired. And as it pertains to, like, Bitcoin's adoption over the long run, I think it's projects like the ones that you guys are working on that are, like, sneaky edge cases that can have profound effects on others. Because for the longest time, like I said, it's been cypherpunks and Austrian economics nerds that have really leaned into Bitcoin. But I think we just need to normalize Bitcoin as a tool for anybody, not just those who are either economically or politically end up on an extreme side of the spectrum of economics or politics. Bitcoin is simply a tool that anybody can use. And I think what you guys are doing at Forager and White Paper is an incredible example of that.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. And you're right. It's a tool for everyone. It's still very hard to get Bitcoin across to our circle because it's very early on. Just explaining our concept to fellow filmmakers, it sounds too good to be true sometimes. Also, you know, like, you get to make your art. No need to worry about the investment, and to the investors, we'll give you your returns. You don't need to worry about the film's performance. So you can only accomplish that with a tool like Bitcoin. So hopefully it catches on, and we can make some great stuff.
Where can anybody listening to this find out more about what you two are up to?
You can follow us on X, and that's going to be at White Paper, and for our purposes, it's spelled WHTPTR_studio. Also, Instagram, great for more of our behind the scenes and actual teasers, the better visual medium for us there. It's also at White Paper, WHTPPR.studio. Either of those places are good ways to follow what we're up to.
Awesome. We'll make sure we link to all that in the show notes. Carlos, Ali, thank you for coming on. I think what you guys are doing is incredibly cool, number one, incredibly important, number two, really leading the way and showing people that this stuff is possible and it could have profound positive effects on preserving certain art forms, in this case, film, which is something that I'm passionate about. I like movies and I would like to see better movies out there. So the fact that you guys are using Bitcoin in an attempt to fund the directors and artists who are not getting attention from the big studios is really exciting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marty. Appreciate it.
All right. That's all we got today. Freaks, peace and love.
Okay. Freaks, thank you for listening to the show. I hope you liked it. If you did like it, please make sure you subscribe, rate, review the show. It helps us out a lot. And also, if you like these conversations, I've come to realize that many people listen to the podcast. They don't know we have another sort of layer of this media company. We have the newsletter, the Bitcoin Brief. Go to tftc.io. Make sure you subscribe there. A lot of the topics that are discussed on this podcast, I write about 5 days a week in the newsletter. We also have the TFTC Elite tier. If you sign up for that, become a member. We have a private Discord server for the elite freaks out there where we're dropping ad-free versions of this show and having discussions about everything we talk about. A day early. Logan wanted me to make sure if you want to get the show a day early, become a TFTC Elite member, you will get that. We have our Discord server. Right now it's conversation between myself and TFTC Elite tier members, but we're going to expand that. We'll probably do closed Q&As with people in the industry. I may be doing Macro Mondays. So join us. Go to tftc.io. Subscribe. Find the button in the top right corner of the website. Become a TFTC Elite member. Thank you for joining us.
Okay.